floor over you.
Walking the floor.
I'm walking the floor.
Walking the floor over you.
Ladies and gentlemen, can you feel it? Can you feel the special energy of this show today? I want you to know this is a milestone for us here on Walking the Floor, because today is our 20th podcast. 20th podcast. We have hit our first milestone, people, and I'm glad that you're here to share it with us. Although I am still sad to say that we have no Dead Peasants shows booked at the moment. If you're a promoter and you got a big pocket full of cash, feel free to give me a call. Although I do have a broken foot, as many of you know. So that kind of worked all right in Foos, because I could just sit there on a chair off to the side. But I don't know that that would really work with Dead Peasants. I don't know that you could have the singer gimping around on stage with a broken foot like that. It's just not natural. It's not rock and roll. Or I should say, it's not honky-tonk. All right, USA. USA. Still in the World Cup. Defying all expectations. Making it out of the group of death. USA. I don't know about you guys, but I got my jersey. And I'm ready for the big game on Tuesday. Do you have your jersey? Are you ready, USA? Let's go.
I've been hanging around this place. I've been looking through your space. I've been waiting for you. I've been waiting for you.
When I was back in Nashville a couple of months ago, recording with Foos, I stopped by my friend Keith Gaddis' studio. He's a Texan turned Nashvillian by way of Hollywood, a solo artist, an occasional sideman guitar slinger, a full-time songwriter, producer, musician, and most importantly, a guy that perfectly represents to me the hospitality that seems to run really deep through the veins of the Nashville music scene. While we were talking, I mentioned to him that I'd been messing around with a B-bender over at Zach Brown's studio, where Foos had been working that week. So without any hesitation, Keith jumped up and grabbed a couple of his favorite Telecasters and stuck them in a big old flight case and told me to go ahead and take them with me, just in case I needed them later. Now that's not an uncommon thing out there in Music City, a town not unlike Los Angeles, where most of the people I encountered were actually from somewhere else, all having moved to Nashville to realize their crazy music dreams. I think it's safe to say that Keith's dreams have mostly come true by now, and then some. We sat down over coffee in his studio, and I picked his brain about his journey from the dance halls of Texas to writing songs for some of the biggest names in country music today. Check it out. Let's just start from the start. I pretty much kind of just run down, you know, your whole life. So we can just start from there. Where did you grow up? Where are you from?
I'm from just outside of Austin. I was born in a town called Georgetown, which is just north.
Oh, okay.
15 miles north of Austin.
And did you grow up like going to shows in Austin? Is that like, was that the closest
place? A little
place
bit, to? Not much. I kind of moved all around Texas whenever I was younger. And but then I ended up back in that area.
Mm-hmm.
West of there is a town called Johnson City that I graduated high school from.
Okay.
And so by that
named
time,
after President Johnson's family.
Yeah,
right?
that's where he was born, and that's where he had his family ranch and all that. And so by the time we got to Johnson City, I was playing music.
That was high school.
Uh-huh. I was playing music, so I was going to shows. And
well, what got you into music? Were your parents musicians? Like, how did you? You have older brothers or something?
Peer
like
pressure. What? Yeah, weirdest thing. Like, I had a I was living up near Fort Worth, and all my best friends that I hung out with and did everything with, pretty much, you know, whether it was going out on the weekend or hunting, playing ball, whatever it was probably about 14. They all played music. There were two brothers, the Hightowers. Their dad was a musician and played in a band. And so they played. One played bass, one played guitar. And then another good friend of ours that we all ran around with was also a guitar player and singer. At an early age, like I remember they played in the talent show in eighth grade.
Right.
You know. And I started picking up guitar because that's what they would do. All these, and you know, they would have their garage sessions on the weekend, and I was left out.
Right.
So, and I remember the time whenever they wouldn't let me play in their band after I'd started playing because I wasn't good enough. And so, I guess that's really how I got started, just because everybody else was doing it.
Yeah. Plus, you realize you get free beer and you meet girls.
Oh yeah.
Well, once very important. When
once
you're
I high yeah, once I finally started playing out and started my first band on my own, I realized all that, yeah.
Well, what were you listening to when you were a kid? What were your early influences?
I don't know. You know, it's funny, down in Texas at that time, the high school kids listened to a lot of stuff, but I listened to everything from Beastie Boys to George Strait, Ray Price to Two Live Crew.
Right.
Because they had some song that everybody thought was cool.
Right.
AC/DC to Eagles and, you know, just all the kind of Texas dance hall music, which kind of was, you know, the shuffle stuff.
Texas has kind of an insular country scene down there.
Oh, yeah.
It?
Yeah. They always
have. A lot of bands that just sort of exist in Texas, and it's like a circuit, right?
Yeah, especially now. But, so a little bit of all of that, but I was drawn to the more traditional stuff. So, like, when I really started playing and started my band, I mean, like, we did songs. We did like Chuck Berry songs, stuff like that, because they were easy to play, mm-hmm. you know, or maybe not easy to play right, but easy to play. Yeah, right, I could kick right off Johnny B. Goode.
Yeah, right, right.
But then I did a lot of Dwight Yoakam stuff, and then we did stuff.
That's interesting.
Yeah, it's weird because I was really drawn to the guitar stuff that Pete was doing.
Sure.
And just Dwight songs.
Yeah.
So I did a lot of his songs whenever I was growing up, you know, because he was just hitting.
Right.
About the time I started really playing.
Yeah.
And
this would have been, what, the mid-80s? I think we're about the same age, right?
Yeah, mid-80s, yeah. Probably, I think I put my first band together when I was, like, real band, where we actually started going out and playing and making a little money. I think I was a senior, so I was 17.
Okay. And when did you start writing songs?
You know, about that time, I kind of started writing a little bit. When I went to college, I started writing, but I wasn't writing great songs, but I just decided I think I need to write my own songs.
Right.
And I really didn't know why, so I just started doing it.
Interesting. Can you talk a little bit about your songwriting process and how it's, you know, evolved through the years from the, you know, being a teenage kid, making your first stabs at it to what you do now?
I can't even remember what the process was back then. All I know
is just was no process, right?
Just, you know, find some chords and start rhyming words, and all my songs probably sounded exactly like some other song that I liked. Who knows?
Right.
But you know, it really evolved for me after I moved to Nashville. So I moved to Nashville when I was 22, and
was that the first place you moved to after Texas? Uh-huh. Didn't you live in L.A. for a time as well?
I did, but that was after my first Nashville stint.
Oh, okay.
So about in 92, I moved to Nashville and started playing around, playing in bars.
Did you move here with a band or did you just move here on your own?
Man, I moved here with $800 and all I could fit in a pickup truck. That's it. And somehow, you know, survived. But I started writing songs more once I got here because I started doing a little bit more of the artist thing. I didn't really come here necessarily to do that. I didn't think I was good enough to do anything back then. I was just didn't want to be back home.
Right.
I didn't want to be a weekend warrior, and I wanted to make a living with music. And so I was playing all kinds of different instruments, not well, but I was playing fiddle and steel and banjo.
Really?
Yeah, just enough to get me in trouble. But playing all these instruments, and I thought that when I got to Nashville, if I could do all that, somebody would hire me as a utility guy.
Sure.
Because I would have enough skills at everything where somebody might give me a job on the road and I can get in a bus and go be a professional musician.
Right.
You know? And I figured out immediately when I got here that I needed to get really good, really fast at one thing. So I started, I put all that other stuff aside, pretty much focused on being a better guitar player and singing. Because I could work the clubs in town back then, it was a little different situation. If you played an instrument and you could front a band for 4 hours, you could get work.
Right.
So other bands would hire you to come. You know, we all did standard songs around the clubs back then anyways.
Sure.
But like, oh, you play guitar and you sing. Oh, yeah, we want him.
Right.
You know, because that saves on the money at the end of the night.
Were you singing in bands growing up, or was it, or is that something you started doing?
Yeah, pretty much from the time I was about 16, I did the whole, I never stopped, yeah.
So it sounds like when you moved to Nashville, you already, like, you had made the decision, like, this was going to be your life.
Oh, yeah.
Like, when was there, like, a specific moment that you know, a gig that you played, or there's just some moment in your life where like, a, you know, lightning bolt moment for you where you went, this is what I want to do forever. Like, I'm not going to go mm-hmm. to, you know, work in an office somewhere. I'm gonna be a guitar player.
Mm-hmm. Well, I already loved it, and I remember... Yeah, the thing that happened for me was in high school, my senior year, I was in this organization called the FFA, Future Farmers of America. It's like 4-H club.
Or, sure.
You know, I lived in a town with 800 people, and everybody was a rancher or farmer or
right.
something, almost everybody. And so they had these competitions in these conventions that we went to, and I put together a band out of my chapter to compete in these competitions.
Hmm.
And we won district, which was like, you know, the county. We won area after that, which was several counties.
Right.
And then we went to the state competition.
Right.
So the state competition, we ended up winning that. And so, which is the big thing. That's as high as you can go. They have
right.
a national convention in Kansas City, and they actually invited us up there, and we played for that.
Really?
But no competition.
Right, just, right, right.
We played for everybody, which was awesome because there were 26,000 people there.
Oh, my God, wow.
But the one when we won state, there were 8,000 people in this, you know, small arena, just all high school kids going crazy.
Yeah.
And we were up on this big stage, and I remember the first time I plugged in my amp in front, in a, it was the first time I ever played on a big stage with big PA in front of a sea of people, basically. I remember because I was playing that little Princeton, 65 Princeton reverb right there.
Oh, really?
And I was always used to, in the little bars that I played, because we'd get too loud, I'd have to put it in front of me for the people to hear it. So I'd be singing, and I'd set the amp in front of me.
Right.
And it was the first time I heard that amp mic'd up in a giant place.
Wow.
My little amp, all of a sudden, I hit the first chord and it just reverberated. And the people were going crazy.
That's a good feeling, man.
And then we won. Like, we won the competition, so it was a giant
night.
Like,
I'm on my way.
And I'm like, this is what I want to do. As soon as I hit that first chord, I'm like, oh my God, this is awesome.
That's amazing. So what was so you came out to Nashville, mm-hmm. and how long were you playing around for? Like, what was your first break as a musician? Was it the Dwight gig, or did you have some other touring gigs before that?
You know, I didn't play with Dwight until I moved to LA, which was almost 10 years later.
Oh, okay.
I came to town in 92. I started, you know, just meeting people, started picking up local gigs, playing guitar, or fronting little bands and bars, mm-hmm. you know, around Nashville.
Is the community of musicians here, like, you talked about how you wanted to focus on becoming like the best guitar player you could be. Were there established cats here that helped you with that? You know, that gave you some pointers?
A little bit, but not as much as just, it's weird. It's not as much of that happened for me as just being around so much just greatness.
Putting eyes and ears on it.
It's almost like if you move here, if you're pretty good and you move here and you really are serious about it, you're going to, by default, get better.
Right.
Just by being around a lot.
Just osmosis.
Yeah, and more than, you know, I would say the things that happen to me more than somebody sitting down and teaching me or just getting in trouble. You know, being yelled at on stage for overplaying.
Right.
Or noodling around.
Yeah.
Doing all the things I thought I could do.
That's a really interesting thing because...
Taste.
Well, you know, but it's a wild thing, and you know, I'm not... well-versed in the scene out here. I really have only been to Nashville a handful of times, but it strikes me that the level of musicianship in country music, mm-hmm. and especially around this town, is like so much higher than rock.
Yeah.
It just seems like everybody out here is like a virtuoso, but playing this disciplined music that requires you to kind of hold back what you can actually do. And you know what I mean? Like, it seems like country and rock are kind of the opposite in that way. Like, maybe people in rock and roll don't have that musicianship level, but it's sort of made up for in bombast and volume and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And country's like the exact opposite, it seems like. I mean, does that ring true for you? Is that...
Sure, and you know what? Pretty much. But, you know, especially when you're playing traditional country music, it's hard to play it right. And also, there are rules.
Right.
You know, there are rules of how you...
Filling around the vocal and all that sort
all
of stuff.
All that. And when not to play. Right. You know, that's what I learned a lot.
Right.
I had a steel guitar player, Jay Andrews. I'll call him out by name. Did me one of the biggest favors ever. I just got to town. I was sitting on stage, sitting in, playing some guitar. They let me get up there and sit in with them. And Jay Andrews was playing steel guitar. And I just didn't know any better. I'd always had my own. I'd really only always played in my own bands where I sang. So I would sing, play a solo, you know, play some rhythm and sing.
Sure.
And so we were up there. Somebody else was singing. And because I fancied myself a lead man, you know, I was just kind of noodling around the whole time. And by the time it got to the steel guitar solo, he was playing his solo. And apparently I was noodling around and he stopped.
Just on stage.
Stopped playing on stage, turned around. I was kind of behind him and to the right, pointed at me and said, "When I play, you don't play." And the band basically stopped at that point.
Oh, the record scratch.
Everybody heard it in the club. All eyes were on me.
Oh, wow.
And I just
bet you never made that mistake again.
Mm-mm. And you know, man, I can get a little cocky from time to time. And I just remember thinking, man, I can like tell this guy to stick it and leave this stupid place.
Right.
Or I can take this opportunity and suck it up.
Yeah.
And
take
learn
my lesson
something.
Learn, yeah.
And I did.
that's one of the best lessons ever.
And after that, I was like, oh, yeah, don't do, just because you know how to do it all or know how to do a lot doesn't mean you're supposed to.
Right. So what was your first touring gig? Like, when did you become a professional musician?
Yeah, the first gig I had that was, you know, really, it's weird because I had a few different, before I ever moved to Nashville, I played with this one band called Mason Dixon out of Texas, and they had a bus, and they had a record deal, but lost it, but I toured with them and played with them. But my first real gig in Nashville was Marty Haggard, Merle Haggard's son.
And oh,
we were
really?
Just in a van and trailer, but I was the I was the lead guitar player, and I toured with him for a while.
And he was based out of Nashville?
He was based out of Nashville.
Oh, that's kind of ironic, isn't it?
Yeah.
For the son of a guy that's so closely associated with the Bakersfield sound and West Coast and all that.
Yeah. And he did a lot of his dad's songs because that's what people wanted to hear, so that was fun. And he had a really good, deep country voice, so it was fun stuff. And then that was my first kind of job that started paying the bills. And then probably a year after that, I got a job playing with Johnny Paycheck.
Oh, wow.
And so I was only 23 when I got that job.
I mean, that had to be a huge education in
itself.
It
was awesome.
Did you ever get yelled at by him?
No.
You'd learned that lesson by then.
The funny thing, that steel guitar player that yelled at me,
yeah,
he got me the job.
Really?
Jay Andrews. He was a steel guitar player, and he got me the job.
Now, were you writing songs all throughout that time? Were you?
I had started writing songs then.
Okay.
You know, like really trying to write songs correctly.
Right.
And because I started kind of looking at doing the artist thing.
Right.
And
I mean, you've done, you know, you've had success as a solo artist.
Mm-hmm.
You know, obviously you're an incredible guitar player, and you know, have played with a bunch of great artists, and you're also a successful songwriter. At that point, early in your career, where was your head at? What were you wanting to do?
Well, you know, all I was.
And is that common that guys out here sort of have a foot in each one of those things? You know,
I don't know if it is as much. I think a lot of people that become big stars here come here to become a big star, and I didn't necessarily do that.
Right.
I decided I wanted to do that, you know, because I could do it my way.
Sure.
As opposed to working for somebody else. And so I really started honing in on the writing, gearing up to do the artist thing.
Right.
And, you know, back then, because of playing with Paycheck and when we were playing in the clubs, we were doing all so much, like George Jones and Buck Owens and Wynn Stewart. We were doing honky-tonk music.
Right.
Pretty much. The whole time.
Was that your taste anyway? Was that sort of what you had come up on?
Even from the beginning, you know, even down in Texas, that was the stuff I was, even the newer stuff that was out, that's the stuff I was leaning towards,
right.
Like the Dwight stuff or some Randy Travis or George Strait. Those were the songs we played in our band.
Right.
And so once I got to Nashville, I found people, you know, that turned me on to, you know, the early George Jones stuff that I didn't really know, except maybe I'd heard it in jukeboxes and stuff, but didn't really have those records. And and within a couple of years, I got a record deal with RCA and started making records for them.
Oh, was and it before was, the Dwight?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, okay. Oh, yeah. Wow, I didn't realize that.
Yeah, I got signed 95. My first RCA record came out in 1996. Very honky-tonk, and I was singing just like, I mean, I sounded like something between George Jones and Buck Owens.
Right.
Somebody once said, you sound like Buck Owens on crack. But I hadn't really found an identity. That's just all I loved and all we were doing in the bars. And I played with Paycheck. And just so I was just, you know, my world was consumed with those singers, with those voices that were so identifiable. And,
So what
characters.
What brought you out to L.A. then?
Well, you know, I made a couple of records for RCA, and at that point in time, things were changing away from kind of the really traditional stuff wasn't happening anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So my records just, not that that's the only reason my record didn't work, but I was just kind of out of place.
Right.
So that sound wasn't working, or at least for new artists, really.
Right.
And
That's interesting you say it, because the album that I have of yours is Big City Blues.
Oh, right.
Was that a little bit later?
Yeah, I made that when I moved to L.A.
Because that record to me sounds like it's an interesting mix. It's got like modern country and Americana elements to it, but it seems grounded in the honky-tonk stuff too. You know, I mean, it seems like there's like it's got a nice balance to it.
Yeah.
But I guess that was anyway. So you moved out to L.A.
Yeah, basically all that stuff wasn't working for me. Nashville just wasn't happening for me at the time.
Right.
I really didn't feel like I was connected or had anything to even offer, or that it had anything to offer me, and I was just looking for some musical freedom.
Right.
You know, and I'd started at that point in time, by the time I got out there, I had started getting a little bit away from that country, hardcore, traditional country thing.
Mm-hmm.
I was exploring, you know, all sorts of things. And you know, what I was exploring was stuff that still made sense to me with the growing up on the traditional stuff. So, you know, Tom Petty made sense to me.
Sure.
You know?
Yeah.
I know it was rock and roll, but I always say Johnny Cash was a rock star and Tom Petty's just a country singer.
Right,
you know,
with
a rock and roll band behind
him. Yeah.
And so it made sense to me, and some other stuff that was coming out, you know, Wallflowers and stuff like that, just made sense to me because it was still roots oriented.
Sure.
You know, that 90s kind of roots rock that was happening.
Yeah, yeah. And were you listening to bands like Uncle Tupelo and Whiskey Town and that stuff that was coming up?
Yeah, and, you know, some of the Wilco stuff, and then I was also listening to the band
right,
a lot.
Right.
And I was listening. I think when I made that Big City Blues record in L.A. right after we moved out there, I was listening to a lot of that Ryan Adams solo stuff, like Gold and Heartbreaker. Right. Those records made sense to me.
Right.
Even though they weren't, you know, Tiger by the Tail.
Sure.
But they just made sense to me, and I loved that sound. Yeah. And so that's probably kind of where that Big City Blues, all those bands that were doing that thing, or artists that were doing, and Lucinda, I was, you know, getting way into that. And it's weird, man, because I had, right before I went out to L.A., I almost got signed to a rock deal out of L.A.
Oh, really?
Yeah, at Hollywood Records. Almost got signed. And so that was another reason why that kind of didn't work out, but I was like, I need to get out of Nashville if I'm going to pursue that.
Right.
And so I kind of went out there thinking I was going to do more rock music.
Right.
My own version of it. Right. You know. And funny thing is, as soon as I got out there, I started playing country music. Yeah. I played, and more country than I was playing in Nashville whenever I was here. Some of it, you know.
Well, with who? Who did you start playing
just
with?
Just different guys, like Mitch Marine, who still plays with Dwight.
He played on my record, Mitch did.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, Mitch. Yeah. Yo, well, so Mitch was in my band doing my solo stuff. We were also in this.
Oh, really? I had no idea. I got it. It's like 6 degrees of Keith Gaddis, man.
This was about 2001, 2002. We also had another band that was all covers from the 60s, basically, some 70s, that we had. It was me, Travis Howard, and Waylon Payne, all fronting, like, you know, with harmonies and all that. And I was a steel guitar. I mean, I was a lead guitar player, and Mitch was the drummer.
Mm.
Trying to think. I think we went through different bass players. Josh Grange was a steel guitar player sometimes, who played with Dwight. Now he plays with Cheryl and
a
bunch of folks. But we were all just hanging out back then and playing country music.
Right.
So we had this band called Eastbound and Down that we'd play every last Sunday of the month at the King King Club.
Really?
And packed that thing out completely. And it was nothing but 60s and 70s country.
Right, right. Was there a good country scene in L.A. at that time?
Yeah, it was really cool. You know, the thing that wasn't really there, like the hardcore disciplined, like country musicians, it was a little more Americana.
Right, right.
But,
sure.
You know, everybody was, you know, they were doing a lot of, you know, it was more Graham Parsons than George Jones.
Right, right, right.
And the funny thing is that's really how I met Dwight.
So oh,
Dwight
really?
Came out and sat in with us at one of those things at the King King.
Oh, okay.
He'd been to a couple of them, and finally got him to sit in on
stage.
One.
Yeah.
And that's where me and Mitch both played with him for the first time. And
oh, because you guys both joined his band at the same time, right?
Uh-huh.
Oh, right. Okay, so I knew that you knew.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Right. 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 Okay. Right.
Yeah. And so then, you know, basically, he would come out, and then I would see him at Mike Stinson shows, and Lucinda'd be out. We were all just kind of, it was weird because it was Hollywood, you know.
Right.
We'd be at these clubs in Hollywood with all this country music, and it was such an awesome thing because it was so rock and roll,
right?
That we were doing country,
right,
in Hollywood.
So Dwight came up and played with you guys, and then how did that lead to you joining his band?
Yeah, no, I saw him a couple of other times at different clubs and things, and we kind of...
Because you replaced Pete, right? Didn't you come in right after him?
Yeah, pretty much, yeah. I'd seen him out a couple of times. We'd talk a little bit. Next thing you know, we just finally just like exchanged numbers. Hey, man, let's go get a coffee or whatever, you know. And he and I kind of became friends before I ever really played with him.
Right.
And he called me up one day and he said, hey, I got this benefit to do for, it was a Christmas show for a radio station where a bunch of people go and play. And he says, I actually have two of them. He said, and you know, I don't really want to get the whole band together just to go play these little benefit shows. I just want to do it acoustic. Maybe you could get up there and play and sing with me a little bit and just help me through it, you know.
Yeah.
Be my sidekick. Like, sure. Oh, man. Let's do it. Oh, sounds awesome to me.
Yeah.
Play with Dwight Yoakam.
Yeah.
Yeah, I already knew his songs.
Right. You've been playing them since
high
school.
I was 16, man. And, you know, the funny thing is I never, I,
I'd forgotten most of them, and he didn't care. He didn't care if I did all the solos and everything
right.
I'm like, I know about what the solo is, I'd always
the
just
basic put, idea.
And I never really, because he liked it like that, I never went, once I really started playing with him full time, I never really went back and learned it all right and played it right ever.
Oh, really?
Because I kind of already had, you know, if I was playing the guitar solo to, you know, guitars and Cadillacs, I remembered probably 90% of it.
Right. Right.
And he, you know, and half the time, because in the beginning I was the only instrument playing solo, so I would play the guitar part.
And then the fiddle solo.
And then I would take off on another solo, and half the time I'd lose my mind and fall off the edge of the earth. And,
right.
And he would just love that. Yeah. He'd get a kick out of it because I was always taking chances. So that when I was with him, it was never about making it like the record.
Right. Didn't just have play to be the perfect. Song. Just play it with some spirit.
Try to play the intro right. To play the one solo kind of close. And the rest of it, just have fun.
Yeah.
But that's kind of how it started. He started it by asking me to do those things. And then I think he had a good time doing it like that. And it really kind of freed him up. Because so a lot of the songs, we wouldn't even do intros. He'd just start banging on his acoustic and start singing, and I would fall in.
Yeah, he runs his shows like a Ramones show.
It's pretty awesome.
It's just like bam, 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 bam.
Yeah, it's pretty awesome. So
imagine you got to be on your toes when you're playing with a guy like that.
At all times, yes. And so he decided he wanted to go out and do some dates like that.
Mm.
So he booked about 2 weeks. This was 2003. He booked 2 weeks in maybe February or something, 2003, somewhere along there, of just he and I, called it Almost Alone. Dwight Yoakam, the Almost Alone Tour. And, you know, we went out in one bus, just he and I, and they had a truck that followed us with some gear and stuff, and we played some theaters, we came here, I think, and played the Exit Inn.
Mm-hmm.
Small rock clubs or theaters or that kind of thing, or you know, in some decent, like the Grizzly Rose, I think we played in some decent sized country clubs where they had a lot of people just to see that.
Wow.
But so we did 2 weeks of that, and he liked it so much he wanted to book some more.
Right.
So we ended up doing about 4 months of that.
Wow.
Yeah. And so, you know, and I was having a blast. It was great.
Well, I imagine it something that intimate, you must have gotten to know each other musically pretty well.
Yeah. Oh, and the funny thing is, you know, is what happened is later on we put a full band together around that. But the arrangements and a lot of the grooves that changed, like some stuff like Fast As You that's, you know, straight, da-da-da-da-da-da-da, you know, that thing, we started doing as a shuffle.
Hmm.
So, you know, he would just switch it all up, whatever he felt like. And the next thing you know, by the time we ended up doing it with a full band, half the songs were completely different.
Oh,
but
really?
That's how he wanted to do them now.
Right, right. It's a continuing, evolving process.
Uh-huh.
Oh, that's cool. That's cool to hear that he's that adventurous, you know.
Oh, man.
That's great.
He's a music man.
So how soon after that did you guys start putting together the Blame the Vein record? Is that that's the first one? Is that the only one you made with him? Is that the?
Mm-hmm. We recorded a bunch of like one-off stuff, different things for movies or, you know, records with various artists. Mm-hmm. But that's the only full record that I ever made with him. How long did it take till we did Blame the Vein? I don't know. I'd have to think about that. You know, basically, we did that Almost Alone tour for several months, maybe 3-4 months. And then it was time for summer tour for him.
Right.
And he came to me and said, you know, I don't think I want to go back to the old band. I'm ready to change some things up. And, you know, asked if I would help him put a band together and do it.
Right.
The thing is that, you know, I had done my Big City Blues record. I'd produced a record before that on this guy.
You'd already done
Payne.
Big City Blues?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
I did it in 2002, and I started playing with him at the end of 2002.
So was that record out yet, or did you just have it done?
CD Baby,
right.
Stuff like that,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
So I had it out there, but, yeah. I mean, it wasn't like there was no iTunes to put it on, really,
right.
At that point in time.
Sure.
If it was up and running, iTunes, I didn't know how to do it or get to it. That was all. That was all new technology, you know, in 2002.
But yeah, I put the record out, and then so anyways, started playing with him and did all that and had a blast, and then he asked me to do the full band thing and go on tour. And I had a lot of irons in the fire, and I had a record that I wanted to go out and work and tour myself on, and I talked to him about that, and I said, man, I'm gonna have to have 2 weeks. You need to give me 2 weeks to go soul search and think about this.
Right.
And he's like, do your thing, man, take your time, figure it out. Now, he was always great about that.
Hmm.
And finally, man, I just realized, I'm going to make records for the rest of my life. No matter whether I want to or not, I just have to.
Yeah.
And I'll figure out a way to get them out there, and something will work with them. But, he was really a hero of mine, and to have that opportunity.
Yeah.
I just decided I couldn't turn it down.
Yeah.
Because I just respected him so much.
Sure.
There's very few people, and truth is, I'm really not that great of a guitar player. It's all smoke and mirrors, but there's very few people that I'll go out and do that with.
Right.
I'd rather sit here in my studio and make stuff up and be creative than just to go play.
Be a
and
side
just,
man
just
or whatever.
Be, yeah. yeah. Not that there's anything wrong with that. I just would rather not.
Right.
Because also when I'm doing that, then all the stuff, all my own creative stuff, whether it's writing songs or making my own records or producing somebody else, that stuff really can't hardly happen. You get so busy and your world becomes all about that artist that you're working with.
Yeah.
It's really hard to do anything else. So.
Right.
But I couldn't turn it down.
Had to do it for a little while.
I had to do it for a little while.
I would disagree with you about what you just said about your guitar playing. I think you're a great guitar player, and I think you hear it. I hear you on that record. Like, I think you've left a mark on it. That's
thanks.
That your personality.
Well, and you know what, man? And on that Blame the Vein record, he really gave me full rein just to be whatever I wanted to be.
Right.
And we weren't worried about getting anything perfect.
Right.
That's what was awesome too. We weren't making a slick record.
Right.
So, if it had a little grease on it, the more the better, up until a certain point.
Sure. Well, what eventually brought you back to Nashville?
Well, I was doing the Dwight thing, and living in LA, and that kind of became a full-time job, and a lot of the other stuff that I really wanted for myself, they were taking back seat. And so I finally found a place to kind of get off the boat with the Dwight camp, and I stayed with him until we could get a replacement that worked for him, which ended up being Eddie Perez, and that was that was awesome.
I interviewed him last night, as a matter of fact.
Nice.
Yeah, he's a good buddy of mine.
And so I stuck it out with him till he found Eddie, and passed the baton off to Eddie, I think in Denver, maybe it was my last show. Well, official show with the band. I still go out every once in a while and sub, but just for fun. I don't remember any songs, but I still do it sometimes. But got all that done, and I ended up actually moving away from L.A. because the country scene that I was in seemed like it was dissolving.
Hmm.
And I was just kind of wanting to go home, back to Texas and go hang out in Austin, and a little burned out on L.A., which is weird because I loved L.A.
Right.
But it's fast. I loved it. I miss that weather, and I miss the energy making music there. But so I went to Texas, and the weird thing is I went to Texas, moved to Austin, started producing some records, playing around. Some buddies of mine that were A&R guys from Sony, Nashville came down to see somebody play. I went and had drinks with them one night. Next thing you know, I had a record deal on Sony.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So I was in Austin for a minute, living there, hanging out, playing music, and making records with people. And then I got a record deal on Sony. And long story short, that kind of brought me back to Nashville.
Ah.
I never went to Texas thinking I was going to go back to Nashville, but that's how it happened.
Oh, wow.
Mm-hmm.
And meanwhile, through all of that, were you writing songs for other artists?
No, I never did that, ever. People just heard my songs and recorded them.
Really?
Like off of my records, usually. I got a couple of cuts because maybe somebody pitched a song
here and there for me, but it always happened up until recently only because somebody heard something off of a record that I made.
That's interesting, because I wanted to ask you about that song, El Cerrito Place, because that song's, now, correct me if I'm getting the evolution of it wrong, I wonder if you could talk about it a little bit. That song's on your Big City Blues record, and then it was covered by Charlie Robinson, right? And then ultimately was covered by Kenny Chesney, who had a big hit with it. How did that, can you tell me about that? Like, how did that happen? How long of a process was that?
It's a long process. So I wrote the song, and I mean that. So basically, moved to LA in 2001, and got an apartment on a street called El Cerrito Place, and which is just up from La Brea and Hollywood Boulevard. And so I made that record, the Big City Blues record, and put it on there. I almost didn't put the song on there because, I mean, if you listen to the song, it's kind of wrong. It kind of breaks all the rules. It takes almost a full minute to get to the first verse. There's a whole prelude, or whatever you want to call it, before you even get to the first verse. And then the chorus, all it does is say, it just repeats, "I've been looking for you."
Right.
And I loved it. It was my favorite thing I had written, but I thought that it was so out there in my head that I shouldn't even waste the money to record it on my record.
Right.
And I almost didn't. And finally, kind of at the end of the day, whenever we were making the Big City Blues record, I laid it down. I remember I was playing acoustic guitar, and I had my buddy Andy Tubman playing Rhodes. And we went through the whole thing one time, Kenny Coomer on drums, Muddy Dutton on bass. And I'm like, this ain't working. And so I went and sat down at the piano. I just bought that Wurlitzer right there and knew enough to play like John Lennon style.
Right.
1-3-5, 1-3-5.
Yeah.
I had to find the black keys that worked because I just wasn't a keyboard player at all, ever. I sat down at the piano, figured out E and A, which is only two chords in the whole song. And we tracked one take, man, and got it. With me playing piano that I'd never played before.
Really? So what's on that record? That's the first take?
Yeah.
Wow. That's amazing. That's cool.
Yeah, it's awesome. And so then, so I put that record out. A lot of people down in Texas heard it, Big City Blues record, and somehow Charlie got a copy of it.
Mm.
And I, you know, it was out.
Did you know him?
CD baby, kinda, not really, but you know, he used to come to Nashville a lot. So when I lived here, we had some mutual friends, so I had met him. Yeah, you know, we'd hung out before, pool halls and stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
And so he called me out of the blue one day, and I was with Dwight in the bus at some souvenir shop in Las Vegas. I remember that when he called me. Dwight wanted to get some souvenirs, and I stood outside and talked to Charlie, and he asked me, which I was already out, so he didn't really need permission, but he knew that I'd just put my record out.
All right.
If I wanted to put it out as a single or something, he didn't want to step on my toes.
Right.
And he asked me for my permission, and I'm like, well, I don't really know. I'm not really done with my record yet. But, you know, I'm kind of on this gig, so go for it.
Right.
You know, and he ended up cutting 5 songs off of that record. Yeah, between that and that album that he made, and then another album.
Mm.
So, and you know, he made a video on it and had Natalie Maine singing, and they had a top 2 something. They had a hit video with that song,
right,
on CMT and all that. Yeah. So it got a lot of, basically the industry knew that song.
Right.
You know, without it being a hit back then.
Right.
But it was a hit because it was a hit video, and that's when stations that play videos played videos.
Right. And was that like your sort of your first big break as a songwriter?
You know, writing songs? Well, I don't
know. I mean, even though you didn't like write that for somebody else, know what I mean?
I don't know. I mean, that actually made me a little bit of money. I never looked at it as much of a break. I was just, you know, it was cool that I was a fan of Charlie's anyway, so it was cool for him to do it. And he stayed pretty true to my original version. So, you know, I appreciated that.
How did it ultimately get to Kenny Chesney? Did he just hear it and like it?
I think that he probably had a copy of my version, at one point in time. And also, you know, everybody that would turn on CMT back in the day knew that song.
Right.
So a lot of people knew it. Tim McGraw's even cut it.
And oh, really?
His version didn't come out, but he it once. So, and I think, you know, Chesney always wanted to cut it, and it just finally was the right time.
Right.
Basically, he cut for the record the Chesney record that's on, called Welcome to the Fishbowl. He did a session. He set up a session, basically, to cut some of my songs because there were two others that he wanted. And he went ahead and tracked that El Cerrito place while I was there.
Nice.
Funny thing is, I had another song that on there that I thought was really going to be like the big single.
Right.
And he decided to release El Cerrito place.
Right. And that wound up being the big one.
Great.
Yeah. Yeah, either way.
Yeah, either
fantastic.
Way, great, that's great. Yeah.
That's wild, man. Like, when somebody is doing one of your songs, do you have any involvement in that? Like, did you...
Man,
or is it just, you just hear it when it comes out, you're like, whoa, that's my tune.
Almost never, but I have to give him props that when he cut those three songs of mine that day in the studio, he invited me over.
Oh, really?
And so I was there. I didn't really have anything to do, you know. I'm not going to get in the way of how they make their records or tell them what to do, because apparently whatever they do is working. But, you know, And just another great thing about Chesney, I remember at one point in time, he asked me about a lyric. They were sitting there working on the band, and he pulled me aside and said, you know, what's going on with this lyric, and what do you think if I... And I, you know, talked to him about it, and he got my opinion about a couple of things, and he wanted to make sure that, you know, he was true to the song.
Right. Oh, wow, that's wild.
Yeah, it was great, man.
That's cool.
And he did a great job on it. I love his version.
Yeah. Like, do you ever write specifically for an artist? Does that
only
ever happen?
Only if I write with them.
Ah.
So...
Do you do a lot of co-writes and that sort of thing?
You know, I do more than I used to. Once I kind of... Over the last 2 or 3 years, I've gotten more into just... where a big portion of my time is songwriting and trying to make some money at it.
Right.
You know?
I mean, how does that work for you? Like, what... Can you talk about how you go about writing songs? How you... So to think about the subject matter, how you stay inspired.
Yeah. Man, let me shut this door real fast.
Sure.
See if that helps from...
Like, I imagine you sitting out here in your beautiful studio every day with a pad of paper and your acoustic guitar, like, just working out ideas. Is it something along those lines?
Kinda, yeah. I like to get out here by myself and, you know, having the piano's nice because I'm not a good piano player. I'm still no better than I was 10 years ago or 12 years ago when I recorded El Cerrito, but...
Still plunking away on the John Lennon chords.
It gives me new... Yeah, John Lennon style, man. Yeah. It just gives me new... just different... I hear chords different.
Right.
I can play the same chord on there as a guitar, and it just sounds different, and it gives me different type of inspiration.
Right.
So I always write different melodies whenever I sit down at the piano. But yeah, most of it, you know, is... To me, my best stuff is me really digging into a guitar and finding some kind of chord progression or hook line or something that makes me almost have to write a song around it because it's so inspiring to me. Something a little different than I did yesterday, you know.
Right.
Oh, wow, that's cool. And sometimes then the lyrics just fall out if that music's right. You know, and sometimes I can sit around for days just messing around with a chord progression that I really love before it hits me. Everything's different, you know, and then you sit in and have I got people that come over, we co-write together, and sometimes you just start from scratch.
Right.
Start beating around on the guitar till you like something, or somebody comes in with this, hey, I heard this saying, what if we wrote that?
Right, right.
And that's a little harder for me to do because, you know, there's a lot of guys in this town that are just such good craftsmen of songs, and they're just so poetic and just better than me at that sort of thing. I kind of have to have some sort of inspiration. I can't just come up with magic, you know, just because somebody, you know, threw out a line that they want to write a song about.
Right.
If it doesn't move me or music doesn't move me, sometimes it can be tough for me to do that. So
sure.
I prefer to write by myself.
Right. Do you write by yourself and then go put it together with somebody else?
Sometimes, you know, or sometimes I just write them by myself and then let my publishing company pitch them to
figure it out.
Record labels and artists, yeah.
Yeah.
And then sometimes, yeah, like I'm going to do that this weekend. I'm going out to write with Darius Rucker.
Oh, wow.
In Kansas, and I've got a couple of things that I've started.
Right.
If he likes them and wants to jump in there with me, then great.
Yeah.
If he wants to start one from scratch, or if he's got an idea, then great, you know. But
how do you know?
I want to be prepared when I do something like that, you know, and have right. a couple of ideas so that we're not sitting there staring at each other.
When an idea hits you and you start working on something, how do you know if it's something that you're going to pitch to someone else or something you're going to do for yourself? Or is there any difference? Do you just write what you write and it...
Man,
you figure it out after the fact.
Well, honestly, I've kind of taken a break over the last couple of years from my own thing and being an artist. I mean, I got right. a record in the can now that's amazing, and I can't wait to finish it. Probably going to happen over the next couple of months. But I kind of just took a break from all that. I built this studio and kind of setting up my shop,
yeah.
if you will, just my space that no matter what I do, it's going to be here, and I'm going to have my little compound.
You got a good compound,
man. Yeah, thanks. Where I can record and write and do all that, you know?
Right.
Got a baby on the way, got house up front for the mama and the baby, and that's all good. So if I want to go out and do the artist thing now, you know, because I need to go blow off steam or just get it out, you know, get it out of my system, yeah, I can go do that. But the last couple of years I've really been, besides focusing on this, building this place, is just writing songs.
Right.
That, you know, really that other people will cut.
Yeah.
But I'd say if I want to write something just for myself that I'm not going to pitch and that I would record in my head, then I go to a completely different place for that.
Mm.
I got to just like channel my own world and my own past and my own dreams and thoughts and all that, because my stuff's a little more personal. And the funny thing is, a lot of times that's what I end up getting cut by other artists.
Right.
But you know, I don't think I can just write that stuff and make a demo of it and pitch it to those artists.
Right.
It's almost like I have to put it on a record, it be out there,
and then
they
seep into
hear
the world.
It.
Right.
Yeah, they have to hear it and then. Hopefully cut them.
Well, that's great, man. Thank you so much. This
Absolutely.
Has been really nice. I'm glad we finally got to do this.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I think I got plenty to work with. All right. That was Keith Gaddis on Walking the Floor. He's probably out there somewhere in Nashville writing a hit song at this very moment. All right, people, until we meet again, adios, amigos.
Well, I've been hanging around this place. I've been looking through your space. I've been waiting for you. I've been waiting for you. All the places that you go, all the people that